the second to last day of a very momentous year, we take a look back today at the biggest political stories of 2010. On the home front, major pieces of domestic legislation were passed after epic battles and lots of compromise. A few weeks into 2010, the Supreme Court's decision on Citizens United versus FEC came to significantly strengthen the corporate role in elections. Healthcare reform became a holdover issue from 2009, and legislation finally passed both houses of Congress in March. In July, the White House crossed another major piece of legislation off its to-do list with the passage of Wall Street reform. The worst environmental disaster in the history of the U.S. and the Gulf Coast took place over the summer with the explosion of the BP-operated Deepwater Horizon oil rig, spewing millions of barrels of crude into the ocean. In November, midterm elections played out largely as expected, with campaign spending in the billions and Republicans retaking the House by a landslide. Democrats managed to retain control of the Senate by a slim majority, and President Obama responded by promising more compromise. He made good on this and negotiated an 11th-hour deal this month, trading the extension of the Bush tax cuts for a 13-month extension of unemployment benefits. Overall, the economy did not improve, and national unemployment hit a high of 9.8% in November. Outside of Washington, a national debate and wave of anti-Islamic sentiment sprang from the so-called Ground Zero Mosque in New York. It came to a boil in Florida when the pastor of a small evangelical Christian church promised to burn Qurans on 9/11 unless plans for the New York Islamic Center were canceled. While memories of 9/11 and our troops in the Middle East were invoked during the rhetorical battles at home, the economy dragged attention away from the wars being fought overseas. The biggest foreign policy shift of the year came with the withdrawal of combat troops from Iraq in late August. 2010 was the deadliest year of the Afghanistan war, and in early November, the White House signaled that withdrawal from the country would be pushed back to 2014. Haiti's worst earthquake happened early in the year, killing nearly a quarter of a million people and affecting 3 million. Arguably the most significant development of 2010 in terms of its impact on domestic and foreign affairs was made by anonymous sources and the activists behind the website WikiLeaks. In releasing classified military and foreign affairs documents, WikiLeaks shook the foundation of American government and now ranks among the biggest enemies of the U.S. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by Robert Naiman, Policy Director at Just Foreign Policy, to discuss the biggest foreign policy stories of the year. But first, Laura Flanders joins me. She's the host and founder of Grit TV and the author of a number of books. She's the editor of the new book, At the Tea Party, The Wing Nuts, Whack Jobs and Whitey Whiteness of the New Republican Right and Why We Should Take It Seriously. She joins me to discuss the biggest domestic stories of 2010. Welcome to Uprising, Laura.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. And you're joining us from across the Atlantic. I really appreciate you taking the time out to do that. You do a regular show, and so you're a journalist who's on top of some of these big stories. In terms of the biggest environmental story, clearly the BP story, I think, took center stage, right?
I think you're right. I think that there's two things, though. When I heard your very good summary there, and you talked about the effect of anonymous WikiLeakers having had this tremendous impact on domestic politics as well as our international foreign policy, I couldn't help but think of that other enormous anonymous player in this election year, which was the number of players who put together $4.4 billion to fund the most costly midterms ever. And while some of that money is identifiable, more than 70% of it was not, courtesy of a decision that took place at the beginning of last year, the Citizens United decision, which I think will go down in history as one of the most devastating to our democratic system. So you have a landmark Supreme Court decision resulting in, I think, a devastating election result for progressives, and a lesson that a combination of people in trouble and a very troubled democracy leads us, I think, lands us in a very dangerous and perilous place.
Now, in terms of the way in which the landscape of our politics played out this year, how do you assess President Obama? Was 2010 a bad year for him from a progressive perspective?
Well, no question. And the two things we've just talked about are not unrelated. I mean, one of the worrisome aspects of the results of the elections and the horrible state of our democratic, not very democratic process is that corporations like British Petroleum, let's forget Massey Energy with its disastrous mining accident in the beginning of the year, are able to, you know, twist the arm of the regulators and influence the politicians who appoint the regulators and then pay for the politicians who appoint the regulators to get elected. So that, yes, I think it's been very hard for the progressive flank that backs Barack Obama to compete, even as there's no question that many of the people who've been attracted to the Tea Party message could similarly, some of them at least, have been, you know, to them, I think, a real anti-elite, anti-corporate message could have succeeded coming from the left, as it did in a very phony way, coming from the very organized backlash, corporate-backed right. So, you know, let's not forget that Barack Obama's presidential race, in a way, kind of opens the floodgates for this kind of campaign financing. We remember the small dollars given online, but he also raised more money in private dollars through C4 organizations than any presidential candidate had done before him. His presidential race was the most expensive at the time. And in a way, everybody on the, or a lot of people on the progressive side, sort of stayed mum about their concerns about campaign financing. But in the sense, it did open, as I said, the floodgates, what we're now looking at, courtesy of Citizens United. So I think progressives are in trouble, but I think they're partly being, I'm at a seaside town, hoisted by their own petard here for having not raised a big enough stink at what was happening to our democracy when it was Barack Obama's turn.
I think you raised the very important points here that in all of the look backs of the year 2010, the increased stranglehold over our politics by corporations was not, did not make the front pages of the newspapers enough. Also, in terms of the role that the Tea Party played as being enablers of this kind of corporate stranglehold, as the editor of a major book on the Tea Party movement, how do you think the Tea Party fared this year?
Well, I think that you couldn't come up with a banner headline font size big enough to, you know, really capture the impact of what has happened over the last 2 years. I mean, we have seen an economic meltdown that reveals the fundamental weakness of our economy, an economy that has allowed enormous proportion of all wealth to pass from the middle class and the poor to the super wealthy. And corporations have experienced the kind of, well, I call it the Bacchanal, with a play on Glenn Beck in the book, a sort of final orgiastic celebration of their power being the collapse of the system that they set up, the anti-regulatory, pro-private system that they set up, being solved by pouring yet more private money into unregulated corporate and banking hands and calling it a bailout and a rescue of the economy. We didn't want to rescue this economy. No right-thinking person would want to rescue this economy. And yet it's exactly what we've done, and we've dedicated precious public dollars to do it. And our political system has left nowhere really for people that have a problem with that to go. And the loudest voices anybody can hear, courtesy of our media monopolies, are the voices coming the right, from the right, who claim to represent the populist, you know, discontent, but are actually a corporate-backed front for, or, you know, it's a populist front for a corporate-backed set of agendas, set of interests. Many of them the same interests we've seen for those same 30 years, backing deregulation. And now it's, you know, let's do away with everything from the NEA to the Department of Education to the Department of Energy. And heaven forbid, nobody needs environmental protection. I mean, it's a very, very ironic end to a year where it couldn't have gotten clearer how much we need not self-regulation, but very strong public regulation of private businesses, whether it's BP or Massey Energy or the Wall Street firms. I mean, this has been an extraordinarily kind of Alice in Wonderland result for a year that in a different environment would have been a year in which we'd said, you know what, we have to totally rethink what we've allowed to happen in our government and economic structure over the last 30 years.
Well, finally, Laura, looking back at 2010, do you also see this past year as having been a low point for the rights of minorities? Not only did we see no movement on immigration reform, but we saw record deportations under President Obama. We also saw the incredibly xenophobic Quran burning incident, or plan to burn Qurans, and the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, which was this Islamic center in New York that took center stage and became this enormous story. Do you think that 2010 saw a worsening of the kind of race-based rhetoric and racist rhetoric that we've come to characterize the right wing of this U.S. of the United States with?
Well, you know, and again, I think the answer is yes, definitely yes. And I also think it's not unconnected to your previous question, where one of the fueling agents of the rise of the Tea Parties has been a particular kind of appeal to white supremacy. People in trouble are being promised that they will at least be able to be not like those other people. They will at least be able to be white Americans in a state that protects the interests of white Americans. That's a not too subtle message behind a lot of the Tea Party rhetoric, and it's written about in the book At the Tea Party by some excellent contributors. The racism buttons are there to push at any moment, and in the absence of a real education campaign by the administration and all of us who care about, you know, the fate of our future as a people, in the absence of an education campaign that could, finally persuade we the people why that phrase is important, why we the people cannot live side by side with white supremacy or American supremacy or straight supremacy or male supremacy, that if we're really going to be a country that's about we the people, we need to get serious about understanding what that means. In the absence of that, all the old, I talk about it as kind of, you know, weapons of mass destruction of white supremacist thinking. We've not diffused them. We've not put them aside. We simply store them in stockpiles somewhere where they can be used when needed. And in an economic crisis, they're there, handy, ready for the task. And I think that's what we've seen. It's been interesting. But one of the few areas where there's been progress, I think, will be a very big struggle ahead. And that's been courtesy, I think, of some very militant action by LGBT folks and LGBT veterans. There was finally some action around legislated homophobic discrimination in the military. Mm-hmm. And one can only hope that that will lead to some real grappling with sexism and misogyny and violence against women and minorities inside the military. There's a lot of work to be done there, but I do look at that as one example where here is a group of people who voted for Obama and didn't just sit and wait for him to do what he said he would do. Instead, they chained themselves to the fences of the White House. It wasn't all it took, but that action was happening at a time when people were told, you know, don't polarize with the administration, don't take them on in that kind of way. That's exactly what they did, and they won. And I think there's a lesson to be had there.
Well, Laura Flanders, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Happy New Year to you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks so much. Great to start the year with you.
Thank you so much. Laura Flanders is host and founder of Grit TV with Laura Flanders. She's also the editor of the new book, At the Tea Party, The Wingnuts, Whack Jobs, and Whitey Whiteness of the New Republican Right and Why We Should Take It Seriously. We'll link to her website from our site, uprisingradio.org, later today. We turn now to Robert Naiman, who is the policy director at Just Foreign Policy, a frequent guest on Uprising, and he joins us to discuss the biggest foreign policy stories of 2010. Welcome to Uprising, Robert.
It's good to be with you.
So foreign policy really took a back seat in the media this year, primarily because of the state of the economy. And it became an issue, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq almost became non-issues to a majority of Americans who are not directly involved in the wars. The WikiLeaks documents, which became a huge story in the second part of this year, seem to have brought back, I think, a little bit of attention to what is actually happening on the ground. Would you say that in a way the WikiLeaks releases reminded Americans of these very important stories that are not only consuming people's lives but also huge numbers of dollars?
Yes, I would. Although I would add, I think the main drama with respect to Iraq is that the people perceive that the Obama, including people in Iraq, perceive that the Obama administration is following through on the 2008 agreement to draw down troops. And, you know, there aren't U.S. casualties. The U.S. has, there aren't significant U.S. casualties every now and then. The U.S. role has been not only militarily but politically in Iraq significantly reduced, and the U.S. has lowered its sights. So there is a particular reason why that's less. If you go back to 2008, you recall the presidential primary, Afghanistan was not an issue at all. Iraq was the issue. And now those have reversed as the United States has drawn down in Iraq and escalated in Afghanistan. Of course, the economy was the major issue. And, of course, also in the election campaign, it was the thing that candidates were talking about, and that tends to shape media coverage. Nonetheless, when there's a fork in the road, the media returns to the question of, you know, what is the Obama administration doing in Afghanistan? So, for example, last fall, we had this drama as the Obama administration deliberated over General McChrystal's request for 30,000 more troops. That got quite a lot of press attention.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, we saw a flurry of newspaper articles speculating about, you know, which way that's going to go. That's coming up in 2011, that the, you know, when President Obama ultimately decided to agree to McChrystal's request, he added this caveat that in the summer of 2011, the troops are going to start to come out. And he's also added since then this 2014 date of, well, that's when we'll be finished, whatever that means. Both of these things are very much in political contest. What do these mean? What do these dates mean, 2011, 2014? We have the people close to the Pentagon saying in the media, oh, well, the drawdown in 2011, that's going to be a token drawdown. And 2014, that's an aspirational goal. On the other hand, you have Vice President Biden, who's been the leader inside the administration of the other faction, saying that the drawdown in 2011 will not be token, and that by 2014, the U.S. is going to be out come hell or high water. So this these two factions are still very much contesting, and there is still something to be very much determined in the next 6 months, in a period when opposition in the polls has been increasing to the war, the, you know, think tanks and journalists are not, and the national intelligence estimates of the U.S. intelligence agencies are saying that, you know, the military escalation hasn't fundamentally changed anything on the ground in Afghanistan. And when the Obama administration has to make this decision next year, which way they're going to go, the political backdrop will be the preparations for President Obama's reelection run in 2012.
Right.
So I think it's true that, you know, this has maybe been a little bit of a sleeper issue in the media recently, but I think this is a temporary reprieve, and when we come back in 2011, we're going to see this issue very much come to the fore.
Other big foreign policy stories that didn't get much attention, some of which happened right near the end of the year, include the START nuclear arms treaty that the U.S. signed with Russia. And even though the Republicans objected, that finally did come to pass. Do you think that that's significant?
I think it is significant. Certainly the failure would have been significant because it would have weakened the Obama administration politically in its foreign negotiations if it couldn't, at the end of the day, carry the Senate on what was, after all, a fairly modest arms reduction treaty. I don't think even its supporters would claim that it was really a tremendous departure from past practice. In fact, the opposite. But the nuclear arms reduction negotiations are a key component of U.S. relations with Russia. One of the signature foreign policy stances of the Obama administration coming in was the reset with Russia, and these negotiations were part of that. So it would have been a big embarrassment for the Obama administration if that hadn't come to pass. Of course, it's also true that in the minds of the Obama administration, the reset with Russia, the START Treaty, this is part of their diplomatic game with Iran, trying to keep Russia on side in the push for increased sanctions against Iran. And arguably, it would, you know, then there's a lot of dissent in Russia and unhappiness about being on the U.S. side of this policy. So arguably, that could have been, that those relationships could have been jeopardized if the START Treaty had not gone through.
My guest is Robert Nayman. He's the policy director at Just Foreign Policy. We're talking about the biggest foreign policy stories of 2010. I want to bring it back to WikiLeaks, which, in addition to the to what this story represents for domestic politics and the sort of criminalization of journalism in a way, on a global level, WikiLeaks revelations seem to, at least on the surface, have created small spots of chaos, whether it was at the climate conference in Cancun with revelations of the U.S. role in Copenhagen, or whether it was relations between the U.S. and Germany, even Honduras, the fact that the U.S. had knowledge of the coup in Honduras, which also, by the way, was a major, major story of 2010. Do you think that these revelations really caused a sort of rethinking of the U.S. role in the world?
No, I don't. I think that the countries that interact with the United States, as Secretary Gates pointed out, they interact with the United States because of the power of the United States, and either because they're friends or foes. So And also, you know, people in other countries tend to know better than Americans what the U.S. is doing. And there wasn't, you know, in all these documents, these weren't really top-secret documents that were released. So they add dramatically to our understanding, but they don't, if you're somebody that follows U.S. policy, either domestically or internationally, they don't fundamentally change your understanding of what the United States is doing.
Even the enlisting of diplomats to spy on others?
No. After all, that's something that the previous administration did, and that was reported in the British press. So no, I don't. I mean, it's a, you know, when it's published in the papers, then, you know, people have to react to it. So it has a temporary political effect. But I don't think it fundamentally has changed anybody's understanding of the, anybody who's following things, what their understanding of the U.S. is. That doesn't mean it's not tremendously important. It just means it's the wrong standard, the wrong expectation to expect it to fundamentally change the understanding of people who are following things. It adds information, important information, to, you know, to what we understand. So, for example, you know, we knew in the case of the coup in Honduras, we knew what the U.S. policy was after the coup, but getting the documents, getting the leaked cables from the embassy proved the contradiction between what the U.S. ambassador knew a month after the coup, that it was open and shut. That was the subject of his cable, open and shut, the case of the Honduras coup. It wasn't murky. Wasn't difficult to understand what happened. It wasn't legally unclear. It was open and shut. That's what the ambassador said. Mm. Nonetheless, months later, the State Department was saying, "Oh well, you know, it's unclear. It's murky. Our lawyers are studying it, and so on." So that's the kind of thing that we learn from the WikiLeaks cable. Not something that changes our understanding 100%. Something that significantly enriches our understanding.
So it just confirms what we. What we suspect, what we know, what's published in sources other than American mainstream sources,
yeah,
et cetera.
There's different ways of knowing right. things, right? That's
right. So, well, Robert, where can listeners find out more about your organization?
JustForeignPolicy.org, and I also blog on the Huffington Post.
JustForeignPolicy.org, and we'll also link to your writings from the Huffington Post. Robert, as always, thanks so much for joining us. I'm sure we'll have you back on in 2011. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
Robert Nayman is Policy Director at Just Foreign Policy.